volume biography of him. Marlborough was the victor of the Battle of Blenheim in Germany in 1704. The palace and estate were named for this event. And among the embellishments was an immense victory column with a statue of the Duke on top. The palace itself is superb, built in the Baroque style by Sir John Vanbrugh. From its immense frontage, there's a long, beautiful walk along an unfenced, open avenue to the victory column itself. On each face of the plinth is a description of one of Marlborough's victories, and the mood is triumphant. A monument designed to perpetuate the memory of the signal victory obtained over the French and Bavarians near the village of Blenheim on the banks of the Danube by John, Duke of Marlborough, the hero not only of his nation but his age, whose glory was equal in the council and in the field. There's a great deal more detail on the plaques, but there's no hesitation in declaring that victory over France is a thoroughly marvellous thing. Half a century later, General James Wolfe, whose victory at the Battle of Quebec in 1759 won Canada away from the French Empire during the French and Indian War, died on the battlefield just when victory was assured. A memorial to him was set up in Westminster Abbey a few years later, where you can visit it today. It shows him naked in a classical pose, supported by two faithful soldiers in front of his tent, while the allegorical figure of victory descends on outspread wings with a wreath and a palm frond. The inscription reads, in part, "To the memory of James Wolfe, Major General and Commander-in-Chief of the British Land Forces on the expedition against Quebec, who, after surmounting by ability and valour all obstacles of art and nature, was slain in the moment of victory." There is sorrow for his death, but no second guessing about the war itself. During and after the two world wars, this Wolfe monument became a focal point for Canadian soldiers in Britain, many of whose regimental colours are still draped there today. Move forward another half century to Horatio Nelson, victor of the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. Nelson is Britain's naval hero par excellence, who cannot be rivaled even by Francis Drake. Trafalgar Square, right in the heart of London, is named in honour of his last victory, and he stands atop Nelson's Column, recently restored and now protected from the dense flocks of pigeons that used to compromise his dignity. Trafalgar Square is just the tip of the iceberg in memorials to Nelson, however. Nearly 200 streets in cities around Britain are named after the man or the battle. And there are dozens of other monuments. The first was set up in Glasgow the year after the battle. It's a tall obelisk, similar in shape to the Washington Monument in D.C. The Nelson Monument in Edinburgh is visible from all over the city. It's built on the top of Calton Hill in the shape of Nelson's telescope standing on end. For many years, its roof was the place where, once each day, a ball descended a mast to tell ship's captains in the harbour below that it was 1 p.m., and that if necessary, they should correct their chronometers. The elaborate memorial in Liverpool shows a stylized Nelson, naked as a classical hero, being crowned by the figure of victory, but also being touched by the skeletal figure of death. It was unveiled on Trafalgar Day, October the 21st, in 1813. Around the cornice is engraved the flag message that Nelson hoisted as his fleet sailed into action. "England expects that every man will do his duty." My favourite of all the Nelson memorials, however, is the so-called Nile Clumps on Salisbury Plain, close to Stonehenge. The Marquis of Queensbury, who was a friend of Nelson's mistress, Emma Hamilton, planted clusters of beech trees on his estate in Amesbury, with each one representing one of Nelson's ships at the Battle of the Nile in 1798. 19 of the clumps remain out of an original 23. Now over 200 years old, some of the memorial trees have died, but they're being replaced by eager volunteers, using a greater diversity of species, but sticking to the tradition of naming each clump after a ship, such as Bellerophon and Swiftsure. War memorials are expensive, and many have languished, half-finished, due to a lack of funding when the original burst of enthusiasm died down. The most famous unfinished one stands close to the Nelson Memorial on Calton Hill, Edinburgh. Its official title is the National Monument of Scotland. It was meant to be a complete copy of the Parthenon, possibly a subtle rebuke to the Earl of Elgin, who'd severely damaged the Greek original a few years earlier by hacking off from its facade what are now called the Elgin Marbles. Begun in 1826, it came to a halt for lack of money in 1829, when just one long row of pillars with a crossbeam had been erected, plus two corners. It earned various derogatory nicknames, including Scotland's Disgrace, but now seems, nearly two centuries later, sufficient. Calton Hill is crowded with other monuments. Most days it's crowded with tourists too, and there really isn't room for an entire Parthenon. As I mentioned at the beginning, a shift in representation began with the monument to the Crimean War of the 1850s, set up in London in 1861. Making no mention of the commanders, one of whom squandered some of his bravest soldiers in the futile charge of the Light Brigade, it shows instead three figures from the Guards regiments standing solemnly with hands clasped over their rifles and wearing their distinctive bearskin hats. The mood is solemn, suggesting the burden of duty rather than the thrill of victory. Above them on the stone plinth stands the figure of Honour, a classically robed female figure bearing olive wreaths in both hands. The setting is superb in Waterloo Place, which is itself named after the Duke of Wellington's greatest victory. This is the point where Regent Street meets the Mall, and all the surrounding buildings are white, monumental and impressive. A further sign of the changing times is that, in 1914, the whole memorial was set back slightly so that in front of it could be placed statues of Florence Nightingale and Sidney Herbert. Herbert was the Secretary at War, the politician who backed Nightingale's mission to bring order to the chaotic military hospital at Scutari in Turkey, in the face of intense opposition from the military authorities. Nightingale had just recently died in 1910, and this was one of the many statues and memorial windows established in her honour. Military nursing henceforth became one of the recognised war activities deserving of commemoration. Britain fought numerous colonial wars in the late 19th century, usually against foes that lacked the technology or the military organisation to put up a serious resistance on the battlefield. The Boer War in South Africa, which began in 1899, was a different matter. Britain was shocked at its inability to prevail easily, at the high casualties its forces suffered, and at the skill with which it was outmaneuvered by daring Boer cavalrymen armed with modern German weapons. Making a bad situation worse, Britain lost far more men to disease than to enemy action, and disgraced itself in the eyes of the world by forcing Boer civilians into concentration camps where lethal epidemics killed thousands. Memorials to the fallen of the Boer War were usually specific to particular regiments or the men of particular cities. In London, just down the Mall from the Crimean Memorial, for example, stands the monument to the Royal Artillery, designed by Sir Aston Webb and William Colton, unveiled in 1910. It's a curious mixture of the literal and the metaphorical. In the centre stands an allegorical bronze group, the winged horse, War, being controlled by the female figure of Peace. But bronze panels set into the stonework show more or less realistic scenes of men in accurately depicted uniforms, along with cannons, horses, and the paraphernalia of war. The Boer War Memorial in York standing near the great Minster Cathedral, is designed in the neo-Gothic style to look a lot older than it is in fact. To look past it to the Minster is to be deceived into thinking that you're looking at objects from the same era. It's beautiful and just a tiny bit comical. Soldiers and sailors in early 20th century garb stand in niches where you expect to see saints. Perhaps that's the point. No conflict generated as many elaborate memorials as the First World War, fought between 1914 and 1918. It came at the end of 99 years of almost uninterrupted peace throughout much of Europe, years that had led optimists to believe that war was a thing of the past, fought by old aristocracies and no longer necessary in a world of industry, rationality and humanitarianism. World War I put paid to that fond hope and demonstrated instead the full horror of industrialized warfare. It killed literally millions of men and forced entire armies to dig themselves into the ground in elaborate trench systems, since to be seen on the battlefield was to court instant death. The British government forbade the repatriation of the remains of dead soldiers, so hundreds of thousands of British casualties were buried in France and Belgium, whose immense and somber war cemeteries can still be seen. The proliferation of memorials established after the war back in Britain created focal points for families who'd been denied the chance to bury their loved ones. France decided to build a cenotaph, or empty tomb, for its victory celebrations in 1919, as a way of emphasizing how many men had been lost without trace, and how many of the recovered bodies could no longer be identified. The British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, thought it was a good idea, and persuaded Britain to follow suit. The architect commissioned to build the cenotaph, Edwin Lutyens, tried to avoid explicitly Christian symbolism, because some of the war dead were Jewish or were Hindus and Muslims from the British Empire. The simple wood and plaster structure he built, placed in the centre of Whitehall and surrounded by government buildings, was meant to be temporary, a setting for the anniversary services held on November the 11th, 1919, a year after the armistice. It proved so popular, however, that the government decided to replace the temporary cenotaph with one carved in stone. The permanent cenotaph still stands there today. It was dedicated exactly 1 year later, on November the 11th, 1920, in a ceremony that coincided with the ritual interment at Westminster Abbey of an unknown warrior. The idea originated with the Reverend David Railton, an army chaplain who, on the Flanders battlefields, had seen a simple cross bearing the legend, "An Unknown British Soldier." Lloyd George was again enthusiastic. A coffin was built of oaken wood from trees felled on the royal estate at Hampton Court. It was strengthened with bands of iron, and a crusader's sword from the king's collection was fixed to the top. With great pomp, the chosen body in this coffin was escorted by 1,000 French schoolchildren dressed in black to the harbour at Boulogne, shipped across the English Channel in a destroyer, HMS Verdun, accompanied by an escort of 6 battleships. At Dover, it was loaded into a railway carriage and went by train to London. There, on Remembrance Day, it was carried through an immense crowd on a Royal Artillery gun carriage, first to the opening of the cenotaph by King George V, and then on to Westminster Abbey. Its guard of honour consisted of 100 winners of the Victoria Cross, Britain's highest honour for bravery, and 100 women who had lost their husbands and sons in the war. At the same moment, a French unknown soldier was buried at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Ever since, the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior has been one part of Westminster Abbey's floor on which no one must step. It's also traditionally the place where royal brides leave their wedding bouquets, a tradition started by Elizabeth Bowes Lyon in 1923, whose brother had died at the Battle of Loos in 1915. She later became the Queen of George VI, and mother of Queen Elizabeth II. Incidentally, the poppy has come to play the role of memorial flower in Britain. Every year in the weeks leading up to November the 11th, everyone in public life, along with millions of private citizens, buys and wears a paper replica of the poppies that dotted the fields of Belgium and northeastern France during the war. All the memorials I mention in this lecture can be found surrounded with tributes featuring these poppies. The single best place to see war memorials in England is Hyde Park Corner, now a massive traffic island where some of the city's busiest streets meet, but still big enough to generate a mood of solemnity and reflection. It's dominated by the Wellington Arch and stands right across the road from the Duke of Wellington's old London residence, Apsley House. The arch was built in the 1820s to celebrate the Duke's victories over Napoleon, culminating in the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. Just before World War I began, it was crowned with the quadriga, a four-horse chariot driven by a little boy, overlooked by an angel, and pulled by four plunging horses. After World War I, it was joined by other memorials, of which the two most celebrated are the one to the Royal Artillery and a second to the Machine Gun Corps. The Artillery Memorial bears a realistic copy in stone of one of the era's great howitzer guns. Around its base are statues of four men who look strong but also wet and cold. You can feel the deep chill of the Western Front just by looking at them. Most dramatic, however, and most controversial at the time of its unveiling in 1925, is the fact that one of them is dead, covered by his cape. Low reliefs in stone around the monument include realistic scenes of the artillery in action, spotters in trees, and guns being brought up to the front by horse-driven teams. The monument was made by Charles Jagger, who had himself fought on the Western Front and at Gallipoli, had twice been wounded, and who knew the bitter realities of the war. By contrast, the Machine Gun Corps Memorial bears a nude statue of the biblical shepherd boy David, holding the sword of Goliath. That's an obvious reference to bravery and to justified war, but it would be stretching the point to argue that men with machine guns were like David with his slingshot. Machine guns were one of the most terrifyingly effective modern weapons that made any attempt to cross no man's land so deadly. Equally odd is that David is surrounded on each side by realistic machine guns encased in laurel wreaths. It's a bizarre mixture of the literal and the metaphorical, much less satisfactory than the artillery memorial. While you're at Hyde Park Corner, you must also see the Australian War Memorial, which was dedicated in 2003. At first glance, it looks like a jumbled array of stones, but it takes on the character of a waterfall in London's frequent rainstorms. Engraved on its face are not the names of the Australians who died, but the names of the places they came from. Careful control of shading in this engraving causes the names of battlefields to stand out in larger letters. Thus, the town names of Yarra Junction, Molonghip, and Narrabarba all contribute to a much larger letter A, which is part of the name Imphal, a crucial battle fought between the British Empire and Japan during World War II. Close by stands the New Zealand War Memorial, consisting of a series of steel girders planted obliquely in the ground, but whose exposed ends take the form of crosses. It's a starkly minimalist contribution to Hyde Park Corner, easily overlooked among much bigger and grander monuments. The provinces are as full of memorials as the capital. The World War I Memorial in Centenary Square, Birmingham, for example, is a gem. Officially titled the Hall of Memory and dedicated in 1925, it's a small domed chapel, centrally located and now surrounded by much bigger buildings. It honours the memory of the 12,500 Birmingham men killed in the war and the 35,000 more who were wounded and disabled. Four statues around the outside commemorate the Army, Navy, Air Force and Women's Services. Inside are books containing the names of the dead, a sarcophagus, stained glass windows, and low-relief scenes from the war. Its doors are decorated with brass lions. The memorial in Liverpool, by contrast, emphasizes grief more than grandeur. A long stone relief on its front shows mourners in realistic early 20th century dress laying wreaths on a grave. Dedicated in 1930, it's spectacularly placed with St. George's Hall, one of Liverpool's most magnificent public buildings, right behind. It's common all over Britain to come upon World War I memorials, onto which were added, in the late 1940s, the names of men from that district who died in the Second World War. But there are also purpose-built World War II memorials. My favourite is the Air Force's Memorial near Egham in Surrey. A bracing 20-minute walk up the side of the Thames Valley from Runnymede, where Magna Carta was signed, brings you to this superb place designed by Edward Mouffe and opened by the Queen in 1953. It feels rather like a monastery with an open cloister enclosing well-kept lawns. On its walls are the names of the 20,000 men killed in aerial action, whose remains were never recovered. Among the men commemorated is Art Donoghue, an American farm boy raised in Minnesota, who volunteered for the Royal Air Force after claiming to be a Canadian citizen. He was one of a handful of Americans who flew Spitfires in the 1940 Battle of Britain and was forced once to crash land and once to bail out of a burning aircraft. He published two books about his adventures, Tally Ho, Yankee in a Spitfire, and Last Flight from Singapore, but was killed in action in 1942 over the English Channel. The Battle of Britain is also the subject of an inventive monument by Paul Day along the River Thames embankment in Westminster. Unveiled in 2005 by Prince Charles and Camilla, it was finished in time for Battle of Britain Day, September the 15th, and marked the 65th anniversary of the battle. Nearly 100 feet long and split diagonally, it includes high-relief pictures of the airmen, the ground crew, the civilians, the firefighters, and representatives of the thousands who spent night after night in air raid shelters dreading gas attacks. St. Paul's Cathedral, surrounded by burning buildings but itself untouched, is part of the carving and recalls a famous photograph taken at the time. The names of everyone who participated in the battle are engraved on one side, and under the central panel is Churchill's resonant declaration, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." A mile away, where Green Park meets Piccadilly, a monument to the men of Bomber Command was unveiled in 2012. It features statues of the crew of a bomber as they return from a night raid over Germany, inside the canopy of a Greek temple. Being part of a bomber crew was one of the most lethal forms of service for British men, thousands of whom were shot down and lost during World War II. To add to their grieving family members' anguish, a sharp controversy broke out after the war and continues down to the present about the RAF's indiscriminate area bombing. It's possible to justify or to condemn it depending on your attitude to war in general and to strategy in particular. But the aircrew themselves are surely as deserving of commemoration as any other soldiers who followed their leader's orders. The War and Whimsy Award, meanwhile, must surely go to the Animals in War Memorial on Park Lane, opened by Princess Anne in 2004. Be very careful crossing the road to get to it. This is one of the busiest roads in London. The idea of the memorial is that not just men, but animals too have suffered in war. Mules, horses, dogs, camels, pigeons, and even elephants are depicted in the low relief. Two mules, heavily burdened with war materials, labour towards one side of a dramatic curved wall made of Portland stone. On the other side, as if liberated, a superb bronze horse cavorts among the flowers. One inscription on the memorial declares, "They had no choice," which is certainly true, but might give the highly misleading impression that Britain's conscripted men, through the ages, did have a choice about whether to fight for king and country. The places I've mentioned here don't even begin to exhaust the variety and sheer number of British war memorials. Let me end with a reference to the National Memorial Arboretum at Alrawas in Staffordshire. The area was once a vast gravel quarry, but has been reclaimed, turned into parkland, and endowed with memorials to dozens of the regiments that fought in Britain's wars. The parachute regiment's winged horse there is particularly splendid. As you wander away from the formal areas, however, you encounter statues and monuments of ever-increasing eccentricity. One is a big model train atop a stone tribute to the men of the railway industry. A second is to circus performers who died in the World Wars. A merry-go-round horse stands beside the obelisk. A World War II-era pillbox stands beside the river at the edge of the Arboretum. And an array of markers and memorials to individuals of all sorts make this the most democratic of all the memorials. Once you've been there, and once you've thought about the traumatic impact of war on British life, especially in the 20th century, you'll never see the United Kingdom in quite the same way again.
Lecture 34, Hiking England, Scotland, and Wales.
The best way to see Britain is on foot. Walking is the most economical of all pastimes, and one of the healthiest, followed by millions of Britons, and adopted by visitors from abroad, who come quickly to understand the benefits. Britain is a crowded country, but there's still a surprisingly large amount of wild land, inaccessible except to those willing to actually walk it, especially in the north of England and in Scotland and Wales. It's hard to exaggerate the beauty of the British countryside, which the American writer Bill Bryson once described as the world's largest park, its most perfect accidental garden. There's also plenty of scope for urban hikers. The Capital Ring, for example, is a recently completed 78-mile circuit of London, taking in many parks, hilltops, and historic sites, all carefully signposted and well-maintained. Romantic poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge began the British craze for walking even when you can afford to ride. And it's a national pastime that's gained in popularity ever since. The country is honeycombed with public footpaths on which everyone is entitled to walk across private land. Zealous advocates for these paths make sure they are kept open and accessible, that new housing developments don't block them, and that they are properly marked on each new generation of maps. In every rural district, you'll see signposts that say public footpath, usually specifying the distance in miles to the next village or landmark. Farmers are required to build access points, called stiles, into their walls, or to make sure hikers can access the paths through gates that remain unlocked. The footpaths often lead across working farms, where you'll encounter sheep and cattle at close range. Don't worry, they're timid and nearly always shuffle out of your way as you approach. A code of etiquette has developed, such that hikers are expected to carefully close all gates and leash their dogs when animals are in the fields, and to stay on the marked footpaths. The writer Robert McFarlane pays tribute to footpaths in his book, The Old Ways. He writes, "Footpaths are mundane in the best sense of that word, worldly, open to all. As rights of way, determined and sustained by use, they constitute a labyrinth of liberty, a slender network of common land that still threads through our aggressively privatized world of barbed wire and gates, CCTV cameras and no trespassing signs. It's one of the significant differences between land use in Britain and in America that this labyrinth should exist." Landowners over the decades have often tried to prevent hikers from crossing their land, hoping to blot out the memory of ancient rights of way. To prevent them from doing so, up stepped the Ramblers Association. It developed as a national union of local hikers associations, founded in 1931. Britain, in the worst years of the Great Depression, suffered widespread unemployment. One of the few activities open to poor, unemployed men was hiking. So the workers of Manchester and Sheffield were understandably annoyed when the Duke of Devonshire, one of Britain's richest landowners, tried to exclude all hikers from his grouse-shooting lands on a high moor named Kinder Scout. The British Communist Party, then at the height of its influence, organised a mass trespass on the Duke's land. On April the 24th, 1932, 500 working men scaled Kinder Scout after some mild scuffling with the Duke's gamekeepers who'd been sent to stop them. They sang the Internationale and the Red Flag, but, returning to civilization, faced arrest and trial for trespass. Five men actually served prison time of up to 6 months. But the bad publicity suffered by the Duke prompted him to make concessions. From then on, Kinder Scout was open to hikers, and it still is today. As Bill Bryson commented, in other countries they fight over politics and religion. In Britain, it is over who gets to walk on a windswept moor. Despite the political radicalism of this early event, the Ramblers Association, now known simply as the Ramblers, soon came to include members from all points along the political spectrum. It lobbied for the creation of national parks, a process that Parliament began in 1951 by designating the Peak District of North Derbyshire as Britain's first. The Ramblers Association also took on the role of safeguarding rights of way, assuring access to footpaths, and educating the public about the health benefits of walking. Among their victories was the Countryside and Rights of Way Act, passed by Parliament in the year 2000, which guarantees the freedom to roam on uncultivated upland ground. It was complemented in 2009 by the Marine and Coastal Access Act, supported by all major parties, guaranteeing access to the whole length of the island's coasts and beaches. Scenic areas like the Lake District are magnets to hikers. The hills there, known locally as fells, are attractive and obliging. None rises much above 3,000 feet, and all can be climbed easily in a few hours. Rapidly changing views from the peaks and ridges create plenty of interest, while rock piles or cairns built by passers-by over the centuries aid even beginners with route finding, especially when mountain mist reduces visibility. Distances are small, but it's surprisingly easy to get lost, especially in severe weather, when these mountains can be dangerous. It's always a good idea to take precautions, and, this being Britain, it's always wise to take rainproof gear. But with care and common sense, every healthy person can visit the region's highest points without special training or equipment. Still, let's hear a few cautionary words on this point from Thomas de Quincey, who moved into the Wordsworths' Dove Cottage when they moved out. He knew well the danger presented by mist and fog. Natives, as well as strangers, shepherds as well as tourists, have fallen victims, even in summer, to the misleading and confounding effects of deep mists. Sometimes they've continued to wander unconsciously in a small circle of 2 or 3 miles, never coming within hail of a human dwelling, until exhaustion has forced them into a sleep which has proved their last. Smart hikers equip themselves with compasses and with ordnance surveying maps. The Board of Ordnance was the organisation in charge of national defence in the 18th century. After Bonnie Prince Charlie's uprising of 1745-6, a 21-year-old engineer named William Roy, working for the board, was ordered to make a detailed map of Scotland, the heart of the Jacobite rebellion. It took him and his team 8 years. But the result was an incomparably more accurate map of Scotland than any government had had before. The outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789 prompted the government to order a comparably detailed survey and mapping of the south coast of England in order to know exactly where a French invasion might land and how best to move defensive forces there rapidly. Among the difficulties the surveyors had to overcome was the competing names many communities had and the non-standard spellings. Often it was they who made the decision about what name a place should have and how it should be spelled. At first, Ordnance Survey maps singled out militarily significant landmarks, but their growing popularity among civilian buyers led to a more comprehensive labelling of all important objects. For more than 200 years now, they've been available for sale. Maps scaled at 1 inch to the mile include every road, track, footpath, railway, power line, church and pub, along with brown contour lines to show hills, valleys and rock outcrops. Once you've learned how to use them in conjunction with a compass, it's hard to go wrong. They're phenomenally accurate. Maps scaled at 2.5 inches to the mile take the accuracy further still and include every building and every wall, very useful in the Pennine Hills, where dry stone walls are the landscape's principal feature. In the last half century, changing patterns of land use have opened up new opportunities for hikers. One is the restoration of Britain's canal system. Built between 1760 and 1850, canals crisscrossed the country, linking up all the major cities to facilitate economical bulk transportation. They fell into decay in the early 20th century, but have been restored by two generations of enthusiastic canal boaters. Alongside each of them runs the towpath, once plied by the horses that dragged the barges, but now frequented mainly by short and long-distance hikers. The Trent and Mersey Canal runs across South Derbyshire, near where I grew up. I never fail to stroll along a few sections of it when I'm back in England. It's level, except where a lock lifts or lowers the waterway. Then it's fun to pause and watch longboat travellers cranking the lock gate handles to lift or lower their boat to the next level. A second opportunity is provided by converted railways. After the canals, a craze for railway building swept Britain in the 1840s and 50s. The main routes between busy centres continue to operate up to the present, but hundreds of branch lines never made a profit and soon closed. In a few cases, the track bed was laid out, but money ran out even before the rails were laid down. Many more railways were abandoned under a politically controversial scheme, the Beeching Plan of 1963, which identified 5,000 miles of unprofitable lines. Bit by bit in the ensuing years, most of these abandoned lines have been converted into footpaths and bike paths. They often go through beautiful country scenery and over spectacular disused bridges. A line that used to run between Derby and Manchester, for example, is now a foot and bicycle path known as the Monsell Trail. The trail runs through a succession of craggy tunnels and over two viaducts, one at Monsell Head and the other at Millersdale. It's an easy and rewarding day out from Manchester, Sheffield, Nottingham or Derby to walk along all or part of this 8.5 mile trail. For most people, a hike is just a few hours out in the countryside. But Britain also possesses some long and demanding trails that demand many days or weeks' commitment to be completed. The best known is the Pennine Way, which starts in Edale, Derbyshire, very close to the symbolically important Kinder Scout, goes through the wild hill country of north-central England, and ends just over the Scottish border in a village named Kirkyetham. The idea for the Pennine Way came from Tom Stevenson, who for many years was the secretary of the Ramblers Association. During World War I, he'd been imprisoned as a conscientious objector. In 1935, he wrote an article for the Daily Herald outlining the idea of a continuous 250-mile path up the centre of England. He had seen and admired the Appalachian Trail, then under construction in the United States. Slowly at first, his lobbying and publicity work gathered allies. Parliament passed legislation to ensure a continuous right of way. But only in 1965 was the path finally completed. By then, Stevenson was 72, but was delighted to see the job completed. He wrote one of the first guidebooks, pointing out to visitors the comparatively few villages, youth hostels and shops in this remote and underpopulated part of Britain. Ever since Wordsworth and Coleridge, there's been an intimate connection between hiking and poetry. In 2010, poet Simon Armitage walked the whole length of the Pennine Way, going, unconventionally, from north to south. Before setting off, he advertised on his website the fact that he was going to do it, and offered to give poetry readings at each stop along the way in exchange for food and lodgings. He then wrote a memoir, Walking Home, about the experience and his meditations along the way. He has a wry sense of humour and a self-deprecating style, appearing to relish the misfortunes that beset him, especially the misfortune of extremely bad weather. An arcane skill I've developed on this walk is to determine the ground conditions ahead by studying the state of oncoming walkers, and the omens are not good. Two men with big walking packs on their backs are daubed in mud to well above their gaiters, and another solitary walker must have fallen in a peat bog because one side of his body appears to have been dipped in tar and his face is splashed with dirty brown streaks. A woman in a yellow cape is sheltering under a bridge eating a sandwich, and when I ask her what it's like further on, she just shakes her head, which is Pennine Way sign language for horrible. But before the swamp, we have to deal with the wind, which is absolutely raging against us, and which is loaded with a fine vapour, not really rain, but stinging to the eyes and the skin, and at this airspeed, like being spray-painted. Within 5 miles of the finish, he finds himself incapable of climbing the last great hill of the entire route, and ruefully abandons it. The book's an entertaining reality check, useful for suppressing sentimentality. The most famous guide to the Pennine Way is by Alfred Wainwright, whose home-illustrated book told hikers that if they walked the whole route, they could order a drink at his expense when they reached the final pub at Kirk Yetham. At first, this was just a matter of a few pints each year. But the Pennine Way's growing popularity eventually led to an unsustainable commitment. Wainwright was also a gifted cartographer and landscape sketcher. In addition to guides for the Lake District and the Pennine Way, he worked out a route across England, starting at St. Bees on the Irish Sea coast of the Lake District and going across two of the Yorkshire National Parks to end on the North Sea coast at Robin Hood's Bay. This coast-to-coast walk is almost 200 miles long and has become another favourite. Fanatics do the whole thing in 4 days, but a leisurely 2-week crossing with the chance to look around you is much more sensible. Wainwright inaugurated the ritual of dipping one boot in the Irish Sea before starting and dipping the other one in the North Sea as a sign of completion. The most famous long-distance trail in Scotland is the West Highland Way, a spectacular 96-mile route. It begins at a stone obelisk at the northern edge of Glasgow, passes Loch Lomond, and crosses some of the most dramatic mountain and moorland scenery in the country, before descending to the picturesque town of Fort William, at the foot of Scotland's highest mountain, Ben Nevis. Conceived in the early 1970s and opened in 1980, it links old coaching and drovers' roads, abandoned railway lines and traditional footpaths to cross the wilderness of Rannoch Moor and scale the Devil's Staircase, a jagged ridge above Glen Coe. The sensible way to approach it is by taking 7 or 8 days. Needless to say, super marathon enthusiasts have risen to the challenge of running its length in just 1 day, with the current record standing at under 16 hours. The longest of Britain's big paths is the Southwest Coast Path, which follows the crenellated coastline of Somerset, Devonshire, Cornwall and Dorset. Starting at Minehead, Somerset, taking in Land's End at the extreme southwest of England, and ending at Poole, Dorset, which is only 100 miles away from Minehead by direct route, it takes hikers about 670 miles, much of which is either steep uphill or steep downhill, as they cross successive river valleys. It was finished in 1978. After hikers recognised the possibility of linking together paths, that had originally been used by the Coast Guard to look out for smugglers. Numerous national parks, national trust lands, and areas of special geological interest are included, and hikers have views of the sea almost the whole time. Crumbling cliffs and changes in land use have led to periodic shifts of the trail along particular sections, but the whole thing is a superb 8-week challenge and is now widely regarded as one of the world's very greatest walks. Of course, most people don't have the time or the stamina to attempt the whole thing. If you're in the area, however, don't fail to hike at least one section. I recommend the 11 miles in Cornwall from Crackington Haven to Tintagel, along high cliffs above the Atlantic breakers, and culminating in one of the legendary sites of the King Arthur tales. Wild sheep and goats graze the clifftops, and you're past Pentargon Waterfall, a dramatic 120-foot drop. Sometimes, because of powerful winds in the narrow valley, the water is carried up rather than down from the head of the falls. Trumping even the Southwest Coast Path is the England Coast Path, a project to create a continuous footpath around the whole of the English and Welsh coastlines, more than 3,000 miles in all, which has been given political approval and is currently under development. Hundreds of landowners, municipalities and organisations have been involved in the necessary bargaining for access, but Ramblers says that the whole system will be complete in the early 2020s. Incidentally, cycling has also developed as a systematic touring option in contemporary Britain. There's now an elaborate national cycle network, taking advantage of disused railways, canal towpaths and quiet back roads. It encompasses 14,000 miles of trails, underwritten by funding from the National Lottery, and run by SUSTRANS, which is the abbreviation for Sustainable Transportation. The idea was to confine it to roads where an unaccompanied 12-year-old could ride with a high degree of safety. From SUSTRANS, you can get accurate cycle maps to plan routes and stopping points. A few years ago, my brother Malcolm and I rode the coast-to-coast cycle route, starting in Whitehaven on the Lake District coast and ending at the estuary of the Tyne River beyond Newcastle-upon-Tyne. It's 140 miles long, and we did it in 3 days when we were both in our mid-50s. It was hard work with lots of tough hills, but not impossible, and we had relaxing stops at country inns on the first and second nights. The preferred way is from west to east, which makes it likely that the prevailing wind will be behind you rather than in your face. So much did we enjoy it that we did another cross Britain ride, the Way of the Roses, 2 years later. All along Britain's national cycle network, statues and sculptures adorn the paths. Often they commemorate the industrial heritage of an area or its former way of life. One set, the Millennium Mileposts, was commissioned in the year 2000 by the Royal Bank of Scotland. 4 artists, one each from England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, were chosen. Each submitted a design. Copies were then manufactured in metal and placed at junctions along the trails, reminiscent of the medieval stone crosses that used to act as waymarkers on pilgrim routes. The English artist John Mills designed the Fossil Tree, which doubles as a guide to English fossils and as a signpost. It's based on Sigillaria, an extinct plant that lived 200 million years ago. The Scottish artist Ian McColl called his design the Cockerel. It's an undulating post topped by a star that is reminiscent of a cockerel's comb. Welsh artist Andrew Rowe created a finger post held aloft by a length of stiffened chain, commemorating South Wales's maritime heritage. While David Dudgeon from Northern Ireland made a design that evokes patterns of bicycle tyre marks in soft ground. Local enthusiasts paint and decorate the Millennium Mileposts to keep them in good condition, so there's now a wide variety of colours and detail variations to the 4 basic designs. If you find neither hiking nor cycling arduous enough, Britain offers plenty of climbing opportunities. The sport of rock climbing began in the UK in 1886 with the first ascent of Nape's Needle on Great Gable in the Lake District by Walter Haskett Smith, an athletic young gentleman who had also set an unofficial world record for the long jump. It's an impressive piece of rock, a spire rather than a needle, but still rated as hard severe in contemporary guidebooks. 10 years later, Owen Glyn Jones, a Welshman who lived in London, climbed the nearby and even more difficult Cairn Notts Crack, then set about writing the first English language book on rock climbing. Rock climbing in the English Lake District. Sadly, he was killed in a climbing accident in France a few years later, but it helped catalyse a new sport, related to, but distinct from, mountaineering. Many of the first expeditions to Mount Everest were led by British climbers who trained on the fells of the Lake District and the mountains of Scotland. George Mallory, who died on Everest in 1924 and may have reached the summit before perishing, was one of them. He too pioneered a famous route in the Lake District, Pillar Rock, which he climbed solo in 1913. About this cliff, Wordsworth had written, "You see yon precipice, it almost looks like some vast building made of many crags, and in the midst is one particular rock that rises like a column from the vale, whence by our shepherds it is called the Pillar." Mallory then went off to fight in the First World War and had the good fortune to survive it. Thousands of his contemporaries died on the Western Front, and the rock climbers among them are commemorated on a bronze plaque near the summit of Great Gable, which reads, "In glorious memory of those whose names are inscribed below, members of this club who died for their country in the European War, 1914 to 1918. These fells were acquired by their fellow members and by them vested in the National Trust for the use and enjoyment of the people of our land for all time." There's a memorial window to Mallory and his Everest companion, Andrew Irvine, at Chester Cathedral. Both men came from the county of Cheshire. However, let's come down to earth again and return to the less arduous pursuit of walking. If you plan to spend most of your time in London, you should still walk as much as possible. The centre of the city is full of great parks. In addition, the banks of the River Thames on both sides have almost continuous footpaths up and downstream for several miles. The river's great meanders mean that there's a constantly shifting view, making visible many of the city's iconic structures. In 1990, work on the Capitol Ring began, and the whole thing was finished in 2005. A circular walk around the perimeter of the whole London area, 78 miles in all, is well signposted and has been broken up into 15 very manageable sections. A free detailed guide is available on the web, which gives not merely careful directions and good maps, but little nuggets of historical information about the places you'll see. For example, the guide to one section tells you, "Severn Drood is an eccentric triangular castle standing 19 metres high. It was built as a memorial to Commodore Sir William James, owner of the land in the 18th century. The East India Company employed him to suppress piracy, and he captured a fortress in India with this name. His widow built the castle after his death in 1784. In section 6, you'll come to a place called King Henry's Mound, about which the guide informs you, "Henry's Mound is actually a barrow or burial mound, but legend says that Henry VIII stood here in 1536 waiting for a flare that would tell him that Anne Boleyn had been executed and that he was free to marry Jane Seymour. From the top of the mound, you can see St. Paul's Cathedral through a telescope. This is a protected view. No tall buildings can be built to obscure the view of St. Paul's Cathedral 12 miles away." The Capitol Ring is not physically demanding, and you learn the history of the region as you go. I hope I've convinced you that the very best way of enjoying Britain is on foot or on a bike. Going under your own steam is healthy, economical, educational, and brings you to places you'd otherwise never get to see. The country's varied landscapes and mild climate combine to make outdoor life possible all year round, while the island's extensive and carefully preserved rural and mountain lands offer countless pleasures.
Lecture 35, Britain's Sporting Tradition.
Britain has a long and honourable sporting tradition. Throughout its recorded history, members of all social classes have competed in games requiring skill and athleticism. Sports have sometimes created opportunities for crossing otherwise inflexible lines of social class. Britain remains wildly enthusiastic about sports today, a point underlined by the massive crowds that participate in or attend them every week, or by the fact that in 2012, when London hosted the Summer Olympic Games, it fared exceptionally well, emerging with 65 medals, fourth only to the United States, China and Russia, all of which have much larger populations. Think about the world's major sports for a minute, and you'll realise that many of them were invented in Britain. Number one in the world for popularity is soccer. Not far behind come cricket, tennis and golf, all of which started out in Britain. Second-tier sports like badminton and rugby also originated there. In fact, badminton and rugby are both places in England where these two sports began, and which were named after their point of origin. Although Britain can't claim to have invented horse racing or motor racing, its people have participated enthusiastically in both. Ascot, where an annual event known as Royal Ascot mixes high fashion with horse racing, has become something close to sacred ground for racing enthusiasts. In this lecture, I'll introduce you to some of the places made famous by sports and encourage you to visit them. If it's a matter of tennis at Wimbledon, cricket at Lord's, or soccer at Old Trafford, you're going to have to go at exactly the right time to become part of the audience. At St Andrews, historic home of golf, you might even be able to participate, though it will take some careful advance planning. First of all, cricket. Americans sometimes have the odd idea that a game of cricket takes far too long and isn't interesting enough to actually watch. What nonsense! Anyone who loves baseball will love cricket too. They're both bat and ball games that depend on the player's ability to watch a ball in flight and to hit it at exactly the right moment, then run as fast as possible to a safe point. Occasional references in court cases and medieval illustrations show us that it was being played in England well before 1500, with lots of local variations. In the mid-1700s, it was popular among the aristocracy, who loved to bet on the outcome. Prince Frederick Louis, the oldest son of King George II, died in 1751 from complications following a blow on the chest by a cricket ball. As a result, his son became the next king, George III, with big consequences for Britain and its American colonies. Cricket's ground zero is a place called Lord's in St John's Wood, London. Thomas Lord built a cricket ground for a group of gentlemen in 1787, which became the home of the Marylebone Cricket Club, or MCC. Its members wrote out a set of rules that gradually became standard for the rest of the world and are still observed today. The pavilion at Lord's burned down in 1825, but its replacement, built the next year, still stands and is very much worth a visit. The British equivalent of Major League Baseball is the County Championship, and one of the county teams, Middlesex, uses Lord's as its home ground. On any summer day, you're likely to find them playing a three-day match there, unless the dreaded words, "rain stopped play," are posted outside the entrance. One of the attractions at Lourdes is the ashes. This is an urn containing ashes from some of the players' equipment used in one of the first international contests between England and Australia in 1882. A visiting Australian side